You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on February 10th, 2015 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss a failed state media outlet in Indiana, Nigeria's postponed elections, and the future of Britain. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week is Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill. It's good to be on again, even if we're not able to join up in person due to all of the snow and man-sized icicles that cover the city right now.
Or house-sized icicles. Yeah. Apparently, as we're recording this, we had to end up recording on Tuesday, February 10th. As we're recording this, there's already been 71 inches of snow since January 23rd in Boston. So it's certainly been quite a lot of snow. Let's turn to another state in the news in recent weeks, Indiana. There was a leak essentially toward the end of January that ended up killing this announcement before it really even could happen. But I found it kind of an interesting story and an interesting jumping off point for a wider discussion. So I wanted to look at that. So in Indiana, the Indianapolis Star got a hold of documents basically ahead of the scheduled announcement of this thing, where Governor Mike Pence, who's a very conservative Republican, former head of the Republican House Conference in Washington when he was a representative up until a few years ago, he came up with this quote, state-run taxpayer-funded news service that will provide pre-written news stories to Indiana news outlets. And they were also going to offer basically quote-unquote breaking news from the administration. Obviously, this raised a lot of eyebrows at minimum because, first of all, he's a Republican putting together a state-run taxpayer-funded news service. But also, obviously, a lot of people were kind of suspicious that you'd basically be handing pre-written copy more or less from the administration itself, that the press secretaries were literally going to be writing, the state press secretaries were going to be writing most of the content, and then, you know, giving it to these local papers that probably don't have very big staffs, and, you know, they're kind of sometimes desperate for content. So this, you know, sparked all kinds of outrage, blah, blah, blah. You know, it wasn't even going to be that big of a venture. I think it was going to have two, staffers of its own separate from existing hires. And the budget was going to be, you know, around $100,000 or something like that for the whole operation. So not like, you know, this isn't exactly the BBC or anything, but
yeah, like, I thought I heard there'd be an editorial board or something as well.
Yeah, well, part of the problem was that they didn't really even get a chance to announce all the details. Not that I was necessarily willing to give them a chance either. I think we were all having our fun making, you know, Pravda jokes. But within literally, I think, 3 days, he had basically had to pull the plug on this, according to the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, which said Indiana Governor Mike Pence bowed to criticism Thursday, scuttling his plan to develop a state-run news website that has been widely lambasted for its pledge to offer pre-written stories to the media. And then they had, you know, the rest of the article is basically filled with quotes from all these Democrats and Republicans in the state being like, this is the worst idea we've ever heard. But, you know, the thing that I was thinking about this is that this made a lot of headlines around the country because of sort of the scope and ambition of it, but it's not totally dissimilar from the setup that we already have unofficially in a lot of ways. And I think you'll be able to speak to this a little bit more, but, you know, at this point, a lot, like I said, a lot of these local papers, you know, in states all over the country really do have very small budgets. A lot of them have had to cut back even more in recent years than previously. They don't necessarily have the resources to have someone permanently in their state capital, you know, even in some of the relatively little states. And they are kind of dependent on press releases and things like that. Maybe there's no, you know, official state news outlet or anything that's providing them, you know, pre-written stories. But I think that a lot of little outlets already are quite dependent. And even some of the bigger ones, you know, some of the time will just take a pre-written document and, you know, spruce it up a little bit and run it as an article. So I, you know, this generated a lot of controversy, but I think that it should kind of generate a wider discussion about where our media is at right now, resource-wise, what the future looks like for that, and you know, what the current situation is and whether that's a problem as well. Nate, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I just think this whole, it's called Just In, that was the name of this proposed website. I mean, as you said, it seems like it was sort of, you know, relatively limited in scope at the beginning. It, you know, this is not some sort of grand, you know, Pravda-style, you know, control every facet of the media type of thing. But it's also, as you mentioned, a little bit worrying because, you know, we're in an age where there are not as many local coverage, local beat reporters in local politics, things like that, where, you know, they're actually have people on the ground asking questions and just, you know, doing the basic reporting. A lot of that doesn't happen anymore in many towns just because it's difficult to fund journalism projects and, you know, have papers that can stay up and running, stay afloat with advertising revenue. So, you know, once you have a government-sponsored entity sort of thrust its way into that, you know, it probably does not the sort of same financial constraints that a newspaper might. And that could give it an advantage. And, you know, over the years, I guess, you know, the danger is that this starts becoming normal and, you know, pretty much we get all of our news, or especially local news, from what's essentially the government or government entity. And, you know, if that's the only source of news, that's extremely concerning, even more so than it's, you know, just a normal news source out there.
But do you think that this is substantively different from the setup that we already have, where presumably these state press secretaries were already, you know, as in every state, were already writing up press releases and giving them to local papers and basically counting on them to just run it more or less as is?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always some of that, but it's not really the same thing. I mean, you at least have, you know, theoretically someone at a local newspaper who has some idea of various types of journalistic integrity that can, you know, at least, you know, maybe make some calls, get a second opinion, check with a different source rather than just, you know, blindly going with what, you know, whatever someone in the government is releasing in a press release. And I think it's also worth noting that, you know, as you note, that there's really this sort of stuff happens already, but it's the key is really more about highlighting and differentiating it from actual journalism. So, you know, say that this is what they're saying, and then obviously you sort of put that into context in an article rather than just, you know, running that as an article. Where, you know, where if you're on the Just In website, maybe 5 years late down the road or something after it's already been set up, maybe it's not even registering to people that it's a government website anymore. You know what I'm saying, Bill? It's sort of just, it becomes normal after a while. And that's what's theoretically concerning. And it seems like people are jumping on this pretty quickly, so it's not really going to go unnoticed.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this kind of got shut down more or less. Right. Yeah. They had some interesting kind of commentary in the Indianapolis Star article. They talked to John Strauss, who's an Indiana journalist who now runs the Ball State University public broadcasting operation. And he said, this isn't, you know, this is kind of the next logical step. Like, he sees more of these on the horizon, even if this project failed. He said that there have been successful media campaigns by lots of candidates and things like that, social media campaigns, you know, so this is kind of the next generation of that, perhaps. Also, apparently, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway has an in-house media operation that's pretty gigantic, and has they have used that to kind of get past the major organizations, that sort of thing. This is a little bit different from that, but it's not necessarily totally without precedent in his view. He referred to it as leapfrogging all the mainstream media people. You know, and this was also, they were going to do other things too, like, you know, pitch news stories to reporters and to the public. They were going to have, you know, it was kind of going to be like a wire service, but also have its own website so that the public could, you know, get the news articles directly from those, which would then, I would guess, undercut some of the local publications even more, actually. But, you know, like, so... I can see where the concern is here. I definitely don't see much of merit in this proposal or any proposal like it. I'm just not sure that this is as huge of a leap as people think that it is or have suggested that it is. Like, I'm just concerned that we're already almost all the way there anyway.
Yeah, but I think once you start legitimizing it and sort of entrenching it in sort of a normal part of the media discourse, it's really not going to go away then. So I think you sort of have to be vigilant against potential state-run encroachments on the news media. But I mean, as you say, this is not like this is so wild and radical and, you know, completely against what we've been seeing over the last couple of years. I mean, this is sort of part and parcel of it, but it is, you know, so bald-faced, it's a little worrying. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't have like just a website that, you know, it's one thing if it's just press releases or important notification, but it seemed like there was a little bit grander designs for Justin than, you know, just a, you know, schools will be closed tomorrow because of, you know, 10 feet of snow. So stay off the, I mean, that might not happen in Indiana, but you know what I mean? It's, they wanted to do a little more than sort of just the bare bones, you know, city website of, you know, make sure, you know, you go to the library for, you know, this at this time, whatever. I mean, I'm just struggling to come up with an example of something that might be on a normal town's website.
Right, right. No, I think you're right, because they also mentioned in the Indianapolis Star article, kind of near the bottom, actually, that there had been a draft story that was released. And it was, you know, cited to the quote unquote managing editor of Just In or Just IN news service. And apparently it was a features story focusing on a Purdue University professor who's designing torches for the state's bicentennial. You know, a pretty probably boring story, but basically that it wasn't just in press release format, that it was written as an actual thing. And in terms of the hires that they made, you know, so far the staff was relatively limited, but the guy who was supposed to be running it is someone who, ironically, has some pretty serious credentials as a guy who helped set up independent news outlets in former Soviet republics after the Soviet Union broke up, basically areas that didn't have experience with, you know, independent journalistic outlets, things like that, that were separate from the sort of party state organs of the Union. And now he's gone back to the United States to set up a state media outlet. But like you said, I think, yeah, that is definitely a departure from just, you know, attention, counties, so-and-so, schools are closed today. So, yeah, it's definitely concerning. I don't really know what the, like, future model of any of these papers are. The revenue doesn't seem to be there for a lot of these papers to stay open. They're providing such an important function, but that's already been diminished significantly.
Yeah, it's just a potential dangerous step down a road that I don't really want to go too far down when it comes to state sponsorship of media. I mean, I don't think we should be freaking out about this, but at the same time, it's a little worrying.
Yeah, the House Speaker Brian Bosma said that the decision to scrap it was, quote, the best idea I've heard all day. And then also colorful comments from the House Democratic leader Scott Pelath or Pelath. Said he was glad Pence, quote, yielded to the inevitable and put an end to this dog.
Yeah. I mean, probably not the best idea for him politically, but it seems like he may or may not have sort of stamped this out. I mean, it might be, you know, do you think he's going to run for president? Do you think he's has designs on higher office? Because this could potentially be a thorn in his side. Not a huge one, but
yeah,
something.
I mean, I think apparently, like, he thinks that he's in consideration for, but I don't know. I think I think a lot of Indiana Republicans and Democrats over the years have thought that they were in consideration and never really were. You know, I think Mitch Daniels, his predecessor, always also thought that he was a serious contender. But you know, like this, I agree. This could come up potentially if he tries to run for something else later. I think that there's going to be a lot of conservatives who are very skeptical of the conservative Republican who opened a or tried to open a taxpayer funded media outlet for the state. All right, Arsenal for Democracy is going to be back in just a moment with some more news, this time from overseas. Stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Still on the line with me is Nate. We turn now to Nigeria, Africa's most populous country and most populous democracy. We've been covering Nigeria a lot on this show, as we've discussed on previous segments about Nigeria. There is basically a hugely disproportionate lack of coverage to any Nigerian affairs for a country the size that it is. You know, in the next several decades, it's going to end up being more populous than the United States. So this is a country to watch, certainly. And they've been a democracy since 1999 and had a long history of military involvement in politics before that. And now we've been talking about various election effects that might be seen. We've talked previously about falling oil prices in the country, what political consequences that will have. And of course, we've talked about the insurgency in the Northeast. It's, you know, a pretty large country. I think a lot of people don't realize that. Even when you look at a map of Africa, Nigeria doesn't necessarily jump out for its geographical size because the rest of Africa is so gigantic as a whole. But, you know, in terms of total land area, it's about twice the size of California. So the area that the insurgency is happening, with the exception of occasional, you know, car bombings or suicide bombings or whatever in other parts of the area, the actual sort of militants on the ground driving around attacking things is a relatively restricted area in the Northeast. And it's a very remote area. And I'll refer everyone to previous segments on that for more information there. But the focus that we're talking about today is the election. It was supposed to be held in mid-February. They were going to have the presidential election, the parliamentary election, and all the state governor and state legislature elections. They were all going to be held on February 14th. That would be this coming Saturday as we're recording this. Those have been postponed. The state elections will now be held in April, and the national, the presidential and national parliamentary elections will be held at the end of March. So this is a six-week delay. The Elections Commission said that this was due to the deteriorated security situation in some of those northern states. Again, remember that the actual area that's under enemy control is a relatively small area out of the total proportion of the country and a very small proportion of the population. Obviously, quite bad for those people, but in the overall scheme of things, not a huge reason to delay the elections, and the United States was very upset about this decision. However, did not take very long for the news to emerge that the decision had actually been undertaken under heavy pressure by Nigeria's security establishment. The NSA, the Nigerian Security Agency, as well as the military itself, possibly they were in turn pressured by the ruling party. But, you know, this is a pretty troubling development, and their claim was that they were not going to be able to or refused to defend polling sites against, you know, bombings and things like that unless there was a delay. And the reason that they were, you know, quote, too busy or whatever to provide this security was that they were planning a six-week counteroffensive against Boko Haram at the exact same time. Now, you know, I looked at various news articles. You know, we've talked before about how the Nigerian media is a little bit restricted, doesn't necessarily have full freedom to report on things. They're under a lot of pressure not to report certain things. But there was a lot of criticism about this decision. Jibrin Ibrahim, who's a political analyst with the Center on Democracy and Development, said, quote, "The security agencies forced them into postponing on an issue that is frivolous. They say they need 6 weeks to defeat Boko Haram. Boko Haram has been growing for 6 years. If in 6 weeks Boko Haram has not been defeated, they could call another delay and ultimately destroy Nigerian democracy." I think a lot of people are very concerned because, you know, up until 1999, it was an endless series of military rulers, essentially. So this is making a lot of people worried that maybe the elections might continue to be delayed or be suspended altogether, and the reasons are not all that good. Nate, what's your initial take on this?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, the key is they could have suspended this at really any time, and it doesn't seem really all that likely that they're really going to be able to secure these polling sites or, you know, get rid of all the camps or, you know, provide a baseline level of security. I mean, we're talking until March 28th. I mean, this is the Boko Haram thing has been going on for a while, and it just seems like a really short time frame to be able to, you know, actually solve the problem here. So, I mean, when you combine that with just sort of the creeping, I don't want to say authoritarianism or lack of democracy, but they're suspending the election. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to call that a step forward. You know, it's just, you know, we see that BBC here, minister confident that poll will happen. I mean, but the question is, you know, when delayed the vote till March 28th will be delayed again.
Right.
You know, under what circumstances will the election actually take place? I mean, you can't just keep changing the poll. I mean, imagine if that happened here. I mean, people would go nuts.
Right.
So,
and this is not the first time that this happened either, because in the elections were supposed to be held, I believe, in 2010, if I remember correctly, the last round, you know, the 4 years ago or whatever. And it was supposed to be held in 2010. And then that got pushed to 2011. There was a very significant delay there. And, you know, there was a lot of questions about, I mean, supposedly that was also done because there was this, you know, deteriorated security situation, because that was when there was still the active state of insurgency in the south and the northern threat was just starting to grow. So you had these sort of suicide bombings and stuff happening, kind of pincer movement from the north and the south by two different movements. And, you know, so on its face, it seemed like, oh, okay, maybe they just need to postpone the election. But of course, that was when President Goodluck Jonathan, he had just been in office for less than a year by the time the elections were supposed to happen, because his predecessor died in office and he was the vice president. So a lot of people kind of wondering, oh, well, did he delay that election to sort of secure his power, you know, make himself more of a sort of stable figure in, you know, more secure in his office before the elections? You know, and again, we can talk about it a little bit more, but that seems like arguably that may have happened again, a similar situation as the real motive behind delaying it. Moreover, this could still be delayed again. As you said, the question is this the last postponement? I mean, it's crazy enough to postpone it once. Is it possibly going to happen again? They have theoretically until the 29th of May to get the power handed over to the next president, or, you know, do the swearing in if it's the same president. And so this could potentially be delayed again. Also, there's some questions as to, like, why they basically, you know, the election commission waited this long resisting all, you know, previous calls to postpone it, and then suddenly postpones it because the military announces this bizarre campaign, which, by the way, you can consult our previous segments. I would bet there's not even going to be an offensive. They're just going to, you know, send some guys out or whatever and then be like, nope, never mind. And that'll be the end of it. Also, we had talked previously about sort of the rising power of the APC, which is the major opposition coalition this time, and that has gotten even more so their rise has happened even further since then. There was a poll conducted in December, even before some of the major losses to the insurgency, and the voting intention at the presidential ballot level was 42% to 42%. And then trust in the ruling PDP, People's Democratic Party, had fallen to just 29%. So even a lot of them who didn't trust them were planning to stick it out with the PDP. But really, a lot of people were not really feeling it with Good Luck Jonathan and the PDP. There's a whole range of reasons for that. We've talked previously about the economy not doing so well for a lot of people because of the oil prices falling. There's obviously the security situation. And then there's just been all these corruption stories, as usual. And so, General Buhari, who's the opposition candidate, he's run in basically every presidential election for some time now as the nominee, the major nominee, and unsuccessfully. It looked like he might actually win this time. He's a former military dictator from back in the day, but that was back when all the presidents were military dictators. So a lot of people just say, okay, whatever. Like a lot of the former leaders of Nigeria, even in the democratic period, we've seen candidates and even two of the presidents, or at least one, have been from the military and former military leaders themselves. So that's not that big of a deal. But, the question is, can he win? He was making a lot of strides in the north. That is, the more Muslim areas that typically often don't favor the PDP as much as the South does. Good Luck Jonathan coming from the far South. The Niger Delta rebels had basically threatened that if Good Luck Jonathan is not reelected, because he's not of them, but he's sort of is more closely aligned with them and their interests, they feel. They said that they were going to, declare all-out war if he didn't win. So there's a lot of sort of desperation on the part of the PDP to make and their supporters to make sure that they can win. The BBC arguing that the APC has essentially budgeted for these elections to be held on February 14th. And like you said, imagine if that if something like this happened in the United States, right? You've spent all your money already because you were expecting to make a big final push on advertising or whatever right before the election. Suddenly there are 6 weeks more to campaign. The PDP has a much bigger budget. So the question is, are they looking at this and saying, oh God, we're going to lose this election. We need 6 more weeks to turn this around. The APC might not be able to keep up with that.
Yeah. And just once you start introducing this sort of flexible timeline for the elections, it just becomes, there are just more problems that could potentially pop up down the road. So, we just have to hope that the polls actually do take place at the original, or not the original time, but the new original time. And, there's no outbreaks of violence or conflict or anything, and we can sort of move on. But, there's always the danger that it gets pushed back again and again, or there's an outbreak of violence with the Boko Haram beyond what we've seen so far. And, I'm not going to be particularly enthusiastic or celebrating until we actually get to the elections. So hopefully things can go well, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, and I think that it's, it speaks to a wider concern, which is true in a number of African countries where sort of the trappings of democracy are there. Most of the function of democracy is there, but there's certain elements that just don't quite hold up. In South Africa, you've got the problem of the fact that it's essentially one party rule because basically everyone who wants to be in power is part of the ANC, even though there's a lot of diversity of opinion within the ANC. And then there's a very, very small opposition that's sort of mostly centered on the white parties, not necessarily like white nationalists or anything, because there's various white people who, were also anti-apartheid. And a lot of them are sort of the core of the nucleus of the opposition. But that gets criticism as well. And so it's on paper, Nigeria's had a democracy since 1999. And, the opposition definitely has won like governorships and things like that, which is not as true in, say, South Africa. But the PDP has held the presidency continuously this entire time. And in 2007, there was a lot of suspicion that, that was a razor thin election. There was a lot of suspicion that Jonathan's predecessor, who was the running mate on the ticket, maybe won that through some rigging here and there. And so
Really?
The idea is that like they're going through the motions of democracy, but is it really a democracy if the opposition can never win? And you know, there's also some countries where the, you know, people are super disorganized and like there's like one big party that can win a majority and then everyone else just literally hates each other too much to work together. And like, I think that's also a problem in Nigeria, that there's just a lot of sort of opposition people who typically don't get along. You know, this is far from the first time they've put together a huge umbrella coalition of opposition figures, and that tends not to hold up very long after the election. But it is worrying that, you know, all signs point toward this is sort of a quasi democracy. I mean, it's a lot better than most democracies in Africa these days, but it's a pretty glaring problem to be able to, you know, suspend the elections when the ruling party that's held power since 1999 suddenly looks like they might actually be in serious trouble. All right, well, we're going to look in our next segment at the elections in Britain. Stick around for that from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Still on the line with me is Nate. We're turning now to the upcoming general elections, further ahead than the Nigerian elections. These are in Britain in May. You know, a lot of attention focused on those because, you know, we are always interested in Britain as Americans. I think that everyone's got a little bit of the Anglophilia in them. And I think a lot of people also were kind of interested in the Scotland independence referendum that happened last year. We talked about it some on the show as well. You know, this is something that kind of appeals to a lot of Americans, I think, a bit of a William Wallace type passion for that cause. But, you know, so I think there's maybe going to be a little bit more attention than usual on the election results in Britain this year. But it's gonna the picture is gonna be pretty complicated. This is not going to be a straightforward, you know, liberal, you know, Labour versus Conservatives outcome that we maybe used to see in the past. I think that a lot of people are saying that ship has permanently sailed, arguably, because last time they had a hung parliament where, you know, no single party had enough for a majority, so they had to have the Conservative Liberal Democrats enter into coalition together, and that hasn't worked out very well for the Liberal Democrats, certainly. And so, you know, a lot of people are very interested in what the outcome is going to be there. Some interesting statistics. The Conservatives haven't gotten more than 40% of the vote in something like two decades now. You know, they're still able to get close to a majority sometimes, but this is kind of been on a downward slide for them. We've also seen the emergence of these other parties, and that has been particularly true this year. The three major minor forces, effectively, this year are the SNP, UKIP, or UKIP, and the Greens. So the Green Party is not really expected to win any more seats. They're just going to have basically one seat, and that's going to be it. The effect that they may have is that their party membership has increased very rapidly, particularly in England and to some extent in Scotland, and they may be able to tip some races from Labour to somebody else, because that would be probably their most natural competitor, except possibly in Wales. And so the Green Party, you know, they've been growing rapidly in membership, but very disorganized. But they're mostly expected to play a spoiler, at least this year around. Maybe, you know, next time, 5 years from now, or whenever the next election is, they will perhaps be more organized and able to, you know, actually win more seats. UKIP playing an interesting role where they may actually win, you know, five or so seats. Not that many, but nothing to sneeze at when you consider kind of how extreme they are. They had been, as I think we've talked about before, kind of positioning themselves as a very, you know, oh, we're just opposed to the European Union. We just want our sovereignty back. And, you know, we're not anti-immigrant. We're not xenophobic. We just want reasonable controls on immigration. And, you know, some of it was, you could kind of see through it. But the real mask came off after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in France, where basically they just were straight up going on Fox News channel, you know, in the United States to endorse various crazy things that Fox News was saying about Muslims and Muslims in Britain in particular. So they're kind of openly campaigning as racists at this point. The big thing there, besides the actual seats that they will win, is that they are posing a major threat to a lot of other conservative seats, you know, putting them enough in jeopardy that the conservatives will have to spend a lot of money kind of protecting those seats where they can't be campaigning against, you know, Labor or whoever else. But also, and that's sort of also forcing the Conservative Party to shift a lot of their positions. UKIP is also a threat to Labor in certain constituencies, similar to what we've seen in France, where the Front National Party, you know, often does very well in areas that used to be strongholds of the Communist Party of France. These areas, these very sort of industrial areas that don't have industry anymore, and then people are upset about that. The party seems to have shifted away from them, and so they turn to other alternatives, including the far right, even if they were originally, you know, quite strongly left. And so that is also, you know, putting Labor in a bit of a bind where they try to figure out whether or not they want to just ignore UKIP or try to, you know, make kind of light overtures to some of the extreme positions. I would recommend against doing that, but no one really cares about my opinion on this, certainly. And but that kind of gets to that bigger challenge that Labor faces in general, and that is sort of manifested most clearly by the SNP, the Scottish National Party. And Labour's challenge is that they moved kind of toward the center or even to the right, I guess, arguably, under Tony Blair very intentionally. You know, that was part of his sort of Clinton-esque strategy, literally explicitly based off of Bill Clinton. Blair was elected in 1997. So at that point, Bill Clinton had been elected president, lost Congress in the first midterms, and then been reelected. And Tony Blair looked at that and said, yeah, I want to do that here too. Because at that point, Labor had been out of power for almost 20 years or something. So, you know, since 1979. So at that point, I think everyone was getting a little bit antsy. And so he was kind of, you know, people were getting desperate. So they were willing to try that. But that has really frustrated a lot of the sort of left-leaning base of the Labour Party, and that's where the Scottish National Party comes in. Obviously, their big like push to, you know, gain momentum was that referendum last year where they were ultimately unsuccessful in gaining independence for Scotland, but it really showed that they were a potent organizing force and that they could do some really serious, you know, political work if they wanted to. And not just in the local elections. So they are campaigning very seriously right now. And they, at the moment, only have about 6 seats in London. And they've decided to make a serious push for the national parliamentary elections. And they may win, 35 or 40 seats, you know, or even more relative to what they have now. And that is sort of a huge game changer because Labour has often counted on having that deep reserve of basically diehard leftist seats, constituencies in Scotland that they didn't have to campaign at all in because Conservative Party has been basically dead up there since Margaret Thatcher and people were actively cheering when she died. So like, you know, the SNP is campaigning in this election far less on the principle of Scotland should be an independent nation and far more on we want leftist economic policy, you know, not far left or anything, but just reasonably leftist like Labour used to be. We want more funding for the NHS in Scotland, more funding for various other government services in Scotland. You know, they are oriented towards Scotland, but that's their sort of fiscal priorities. And then they're also continue to be, you know, anti-nuclear weapon, you know, questioning the value of NATO, things like that, sort of challenging these very Blairist positions within the mainstream Labour Party that have moved toward this sort of militarized position, much like a lot of Democrats in the United States have kind of positioned themselves far more toward the, you know, hawkish side of foreign affairs. you know, and the Liberal Democrats are basically down and out. Like, they've been destroyed by being in this coalition government. They're projected to win, to lose rather, almost 30 seats net, basically cutting their entire strength directly in half. And the Conservatives and Labor themselves are basically probably going to win about the same number of seats. And the SNP is never going to work with the Conservatives. So that's essentially going to leave the likeliest outcome being a Labor-SNP coalition, possibly with, you know, maybe the Green thrown in, or some of the Northern Irish parties or the Welsh parties, that kind of thing. So that's sort of the huge background going into this election. Those are the fundamental questions posed here. Nate, what's your take on this breakdown, and also what we might see from, you know, some of these coalition arrangements?
Yeah, I thought you did a pretty good job explaining it. You know, the worry for Labor, obviously, is, you know, you have these constituencies and sort of, I wouldn't compare it to like the solid South or something like that, but you sort of have like a built-in reservoir where if you start losing that, then that immediately hurts your ability to compete both, you know, in the sort of swing areas, swing seats, and just in general. So, you know, the fact that Labor is going to have to be sort of defending its rear guard action, you know, that makes it more difficult for them to sort of gain the number of seats it wants to. As you know, there's always the possibility of a coalition. So, you know, you just sort of have to wonder if that's something that'll take shape down the road. Then, of course, you know, with the rise of the UKIP, you know, that sort of changes the discourse a little bit and sort of changes the way that all of these issues are framed, because once the UKIP's sort of positions start becoming mainstream, you know, or at least, you know, in the center of the political discussion, then, you know, that forces other groups to sort of respond to that, and, you know, that could potentially influence the election as well. But, you know, as we've seen, these sort of UK elections aren't quite the same as the more sort of year-long American counterparts, where you just sort of have all these narratives and storylines that are always constantly changing and then being rewritten, and just you know, there are all these little things that happen over the course of a year-long campaign that don't necessarily happen in Britain. So things are a little different there.
Right. But I think it's interesting too, though, that, you know, they have way more seats and much smaller districts than our own Congress does. I think, and there's going to be about like 50 seats that are in play, like not even ones that are not, like, there are some that are definitely going to switch parties. Even if you take out those, there's like ones that are basically swing districts that are still too close to call at this point. That's like 50 seats, according to, you know, The Guardian a couple weeks ago. And you and I had talked last year after that Supreme Court decision in the United States that basically lifted the restrictions on how many races you could donate to in the United States, or the effective cumulative limit, which by default meant how many races you could donate to. And we had talked about how that had kind of created an effect where most of the money in the United States goes to a very limited number of races. So the actual, like, swing margin of races, the sort of battleground races for the U.S. House of Representatives, tends to be only about 20 seats. Now that's starting to change a little bit, but I think it is interesting that they've got like 50 seats as swing ones, let alone all of these, you know, 40 some odd seats that are going to automatically flip to the SNP or appear to be on track to automatically flip. So this is a whole new world, I think, for Britain. This is a very enlarged map for competition, which, you know, is probably not the worst thing in the world. You know, force them to shake up their issues and their platforms and everything. But like you said, it's a little bit troubling when the people that are really driving the debate are this relatively small, essentially racist party.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the huge issue. It's not that there's a broader, you know, variety of political opinions, and you got the libertarians in there, and the Greens have a strong following and strong party. I mean, the big difference is now, I mean, obviously the Scotland stuff, and you have the SNP there, but the rise of a sort of a nationalist British identity and the sort of associated xenophobia is something that's extremely worrying. And you know, this could potentially be an election that legitimizes them. And that's something that, I mean, if that's the road we're going down towards, I mean, we could see a well, I won't get into all the sort of alternate reality V for Vendetta type scenarios of a you know, sort of authoritarian Britain, but you know, just some of the stuff these guys are unabashedly standing for is pretty almost, I wouldn't say sickening, or just these are not the positions that should be, or sentiments, I think, more even than necessarily their sort of stated ideological positions. You know, you don't want these guys to be in a ruling coalition. I mean, you just don't.
Right. And I think that you touch on an interesting point here, which is that a lot of this is about identity. And, you know, there's been a lot of focus on, there was even an article in The Guardian in the past week or so, you know, someone saying, you know, stop asking what Britain's role in the world is without its empire. We've already been asking that question too many times. I think that the interesting question is not what is Britain's role in the world without its empire. It's what is the British identity at home without an empire? You know, that part I don't think has been asked very clearly. And I honestly, I think that you know, beyond Scottish nationalism or a sort of xenophobic British nationalism, the rise of SNP and the rise of UKIP, at its heart, those are driven by sort of fiscal identity questions. And I think that fiscal is often a shorthand for identity and vice versa, where basically, you know, what you prioritize in your budget and where you get your tax money from, that defines, you know, your identity as a party, your identity as a nation, that sort of thing, right? If you spend a whole lot of money on taking care of the poor and, you know, trying to equalize society, things like that, you get a reputation like the Nordic countries, right? And like a lot of the, you know, Scandinavian countries have kind of been coasting on that for a while. I mean, Sweden's been headed in a pretty conservative direction for quite some time now. And, you know, not just on the sort of immigration related issues, but also just economically. And they're still coasting on that global reputation. And maybe it's just because it's by comparison to everyone else of being, you know, a much more, you know, a very differently oriented society, much more egalitarian and that sort of thing. And I think that like that kind of fiscal prioritization is how you demonstrate your national priorities. And so for the SNP, like the quote unquote Scottish national identity is, you know, anti-militarist, anti-nuclear, pro-health spending, pro, you know, industrial policy. They want to use the North Sea oil revenues to invest in, you know, public projects and education and things like that, which I don't think is the worst thing in the world. You know, but like, ostensibly, they're mad that outsiders are controlling it, right? You know, not Scotland is setting policy in Scotland, or Europe is setting policy in Britain. And that's the part that they claim to be upset about. But I think that they're less upset about who's making the decision and more upset about what the decisions are, because if they agreed with them, they wouldn't be fighting it. And this is, you know, it goes to that issue of nobody really asked anyone in Britain to like say, hey, what do you guys stand for at home now that you don't have the empire? Like, what are your sort of fiscal priorities? Are you going to be, you know, beefed up militarily, or are you going to scale that back? Are you going to, you know, change your nuclear policy? Are you going to change, you know, the NHS? Are you going to, you know, what are the sort of big picture issues? And I think that Labour and the Conservatives and even the Liberal Democrats kind of converged on so many issues, like most of the mainstream parties in Europe, which is why we're also seeing a lot of this similar backlash from new parties in other places as well. Like, they converged so much that it was sort of indistinguishable. And that's hard to run on when you get a moment like this where everyone's just really frustrated. And honestly, like, maybe I'm being naive, but it seems like a Labour-SNP coalition could be really good for not just the country, but Labour itself, in terms of like reprioritizing some of that old focus on traditionally, you know, left oriented, worker oriented policies, not saying like, oh, let's all go be protectionists or whatever, like the SNP's, you know, pro-European Union and everything too, but saying like, let's invest in our sort of base population. Let's like raise people up. Let's make those domestic spending priorities. Let's not go on these weird military adventures and be constantly threatening to like fire two Tomahawk missiles at Syria while the U.S. fires like 25. So, you know, like that, to me, it seems like that could be a potentially very good outcome for a lot of folks. Nate, what do you think about the idea of a labor S&P coalition in terms of potentially, you know, not just for the country, but for labor itself, of kind of refinding itself after that drift that set in under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown?
Yeah, I mean, if this is a way to sort of achieve that and maybe find a way to intertwine some of its sort of traditional or socialist policies with a support for, you know, more of an independent Scotland or independent aspects to Scotland, that could appeal to some people. Or if there's generally a decent sort of rapport between SNP and Labour going into the election. So it's all about sort of, I guess, perception and whether these parties would be willing to work together, how much their sort of stated economic goals come into conflict, whether they could work that out. So, I mean, of all the various coalitions, it seems like that could be one of the more likely ones, or maybe not likely based on results, but just based on the parties working together. Maybe UKIP might find itself in a coalition if the Conservatives win, but I mean, I don't know. So, you know, you hope not, but at the same time, you know, you never know. So, yeah, I mean, that probably will be the best thing going forward for Labour, especially if they lose some of those Scotland seats. They may need SNP in order to keep a hold on Parliament, or to get a hold on Parliament.
All right. Well, we're going to continue to follow this election as the campaign starts to unfold in Britain. But Nate, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about these three news stories.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.